thinking of not telling you that, at least. So, you haven't learned any history. Haven't you done any translating, either?
I've done some, Vivian admitted.
Well, let's hear it, then.
Dr. Willander leaned back and lit his pipe with a tap of one huge finger on its bowl, as if he expected to be listening for the next hour or so. Vivian looked miserably at her few lines of crossed-out and rewritten green writing.
One large blacksmith threw four coffins about, she read.
Jonathan hurriedly stuffed a doubled-up lump of pigtail into his mouth.
Oh, did he?
Dr. Willander said placidly.
To show off his strength, I suppose. Carry on.
So that they turned into four very old women, Vivian read. One went rusty for smoothing clothes. Two went white in moderately cheap jewellery. Three of them turned expensive and got yellow. And another four were dense and low in the tables.
So, now there were 10 coffins,
Dr. Willander said.
Or maybe 10 strange elderly ladies. Some of these were doing the laundry, while the rest pranced about in cheap necklaces. I suppose the yellow ones caught jaundice at the sight, while the stupid ones crawled under the furniture in order not to look. Is there any more of this lively narrative?
A bit, said Vivian. Four more were full of electricity, but they were insulated with policemen, so that the town could learn philosophy for at least a year.
Four more old women, and an unspecified number of police,
Dr. Willander remarked.
The blacksmith makes at least 15. Well, I hope he paid the police for wrapping themselves around the electrical old ladies. It sounds painful. Or are you implying that the police were electrocuted, thus supplying the townsfolk with a valuable moral lesson?
I don't know, Vivian said hopelessly.
But just what,
asked Dr. Willander,
do you think your multitudes of old women were really doing?
I've no idea, Vivian confessed.
Well, people don't usually write nonsense,
Dr. Willander remarked, still placidly puffing at his pipe.
Pass the paper to Jonathan. Perhaps he can tell us what all these people were up to.
Jonathan took the paper out of Vivian's hand. He looked at it and stuffed another lump of pigtail into his mouth. Tears trickled from under the flicker of his eye function.
Jonathan considers it to be a tragedy,
Dr. Willander growled sadly.
The police were killed by high-voltage crones. Here, I'll read it.
He plucked the paper out of Jonathan's shaking fist and read,
The great Faber John made 4 containers, or caskets, and hid each of them in one of the 4 ages of the world.
He turned to Vivian.
Faber does indeed mean Smith, and the symbol is the same. But your old ladies came about because you took no notice of the double age symbol, which always means time, or an age of the world if it's female. To continue.
He read.
The casket made of iron he concealed in the age of iron. The second, which was of silver, he hid in the silver age, and the third, which was pure gold, in the age of gold. The fourth container was of lead, and hidden in the same manner. He filled these 4 caskets with the greater part of his power, and appointed to each one a special guardian. In this way, He ensured that Time City would endure throughout a whole Platonic year. There,
he said to Vivian.
That makes perfect sense to me, and supplies Jonathan with another of the legends he likes so much.
Jonathan unstuffed his mouth and asked seriously,
Do you think what it says is true?
Well, the writer thought so.
Dr. Willander grunted.
He or she believed it enough to put the paper in the time safe up here many thousands of years ago. The containers of power it talks about are, of course, what we nowadays call polarities.
And what's a Platonic year? Jonathan asked.
The time it takes for the stars to work their way back to the pattern from which they started,
said Dr. Willander.
This is sometimes calculated to be 258 centuries. Which, if Vivian would look at that charge for a moment, instead of letting her eyes slide off it, she will find to be almost exactly the length of human history. Vivian, you will learn that chart for me by tomorrow. And since that paper is too valuable to take away, you will take this copy instead and make me a proper translation of all of it also by tomorrow. Jonathan will do me a detailed essay on the Icelandic Empire.
Vivian left the warm, wood-smelling room, feeling as wet and chewed as the end of Jonathan's pigtail.
I think he's a monster,
she said, as they started down the 1,000 stairs. Chapter 9. Guardian. They walked back across Eon Square.
Would you call 20th century part of the Age of Iron?
Jonathan asked thoughtfully.
Certainly not,
Vivian said indignantly.
We use aluminium and plastic and chromium. The Iron Age was when they lived in huts.
I was only...
Jonathan began, but he was interrupted by the skirling of bagpipes from the centre of the square. There was a lot of surging and pointing among the crowd of tourists gathered there around Faber John Stone. They had glimpses of the ghost capering among them.
The student doing that is going to get caught if he's not careful, Jonathan said. It must take quite a big projector.
You mean a hologramophone is a kind of film?
Vivian asked with new interest. Films she knew all about.
Hologram, yes, said Jonathan. You use laser beams to make an image you can see all round. About the time of the Mind Wars, people get really good at it. I bet that student comes from then.
What are laser beams?
Vivian asked.
A special kind of beam,
Jonathan said in his most lordly manner. Vivian suspected that this was because he had very little more idea than she had. The ghost had vanished by the time they got to the centre of the square. They skirted the crowd and went towards Time Close. Sam was waiting for them under the archway.
"Are we going to go after the boy who stole the polarity?"
he demanded.
"When I've decided the best way to go about it,"
Jonathan said, using his lordly manner again. This told Vivian that Jonathan had no more idea how to go after the boy than he had about laser beams.
"I told you, we don't want to get stranded in history," he said. "You know that egg didn't work properly after we time-travelled with it."
"I'll come and eat butter pies in your room while you think,"
Sam offered.
"No, you won't," Jonathan said. "I've got to do an essay for Willander."
Sam turned his widest, two-toothed smile towards Vivian.
"Then I'll come to your room and show you how your automat works," he said.
"Not now. Anyway, I know how it works,"
Vivian said. She felt suddenly overwhelmed with work.
"I've a chart and universal symbols and a translation. I shall be up all night, I think."
"Round-eyed blister and slit-eyed swot," Sam said. I hate school days. Everyone gets boring.
He went stumping disgustedly away, flapping two sets of shoelaces on the cobbles. Now he'll do something to get back at us, Jonathan said. He usually does. Vivian did not much care. She was far more frightened of Dr. Willander making fun of her again. She hurried to her room and tried to force her unwilling brain to work. It would not. She spent an hour staring at the chart and the symbols, and the only thing she learnt was that a pen function was not like a real pen in the most important way there was. You could not chew it. She was forced to get up and try to remember what Petula had shown her you did to work the neat little automat on her wall. Sam would have found it deeply disappointing. It did not do butter pies. It gave Vivian two seaweed chews and a cherry brandy snap twist, all of which were thoroughly nourishing and good for the teeth and did nothing for Vivian's overtaxed brain at all.
Oh, bother, she said.
She turned on some music that called itself Antarctic Bedlam Style, fixed her teeth grimly in a seaweed chew, and tried again. By dinner time, she had translated the part of the valuable paper that Dr. Willander had read out, which was cheating, really, because she remembered what it said. Then she had to stop and change into the crisp white pyjamas Petula had laid out for her. They gave her ghostly red roses in her hair and on one shoulder. Vivian turned on the mirror and admired them before she went down to see who tonight's guests were. Mr. Enkian was one of them. The others were all high-ups from Continuum or Perpetuum, who had been offended by the student's joke. After one look at their faces, Vivian knew that Sempertern Walker was going to have to be very boring indeed. And she was right. Mr. Enkian started as soon as they were sitting at the table.
Sempertern, I will not have our traditional ceremonies mocked, particularly in this time of crisis when everyone should be standing solidly behind Time's City. They poked fun not only at me, and yourself, of course, but also at Faber John Stone. And, as if this was not enough, Doomsday Book fell in a puddle.
Sempertern Walker fixed his eyes anxiously on a far corner and talked drearily for 5 minutes about youthful high spirits and not condone it in the least, but should endeavour to take a lenient, quasi-parental line. Mr. Enkian waited for him to stop and said,
I shall put forward a motion in chronologue. My colleagues here will vote for it. In future we shall ban all students from 67th century or any other era with disruptive technology.
Which meant that Sempertern Walker had to fix his gaze on another corner and drone on again about a balanced mix of students from all feasible eras. Vivian watched him while he talked, and willed him to jump up from the table and run about shouting the way he had that morning. It would be so much more interesting. And she was sure it would shut Mr. Enkian up in seconds.
"We don't take students from unstable eras," Mr. Enkian snapped. "If we already ban everyone from 58 to 65 centuries, we can quite easily extend the ban to cover 56th century as well. That's where the culprit came from, I'm positive of that."
"But if we did that,"
Sempertern Walker said, crumbling the food in his dish and looking as if he had toothache,
"we'd run the risk of attempting to exclude some student whom history states to have studied here. This would initiate instability in that era."
"Please?"
Vivian asked, while Mr. Enkian was opening his mouth to reply.
"Please, why don't you have people from unstable eras?"
As soon as she said it, she realized how very brave Jonathan had been to interrupt the talk the night before. Mr. Enkian glared at her. Sempertern Walker turned his toothache look on her. Vivian felt her face going hot. But Sempertern Walker seemed to think her question was perfectly reasonable.
"We don't let them in for a number of reasons," he said. "The most important one is that we need the unstable eras to stay just as they are in order to keep the fixed eras steady. We can't have a man from, say, 60 century, knowing he could come to Time City and find out about his future. We rely on his era, the third unstable era, to have the wars and make the inventions which lead to the Icelandic Empire in the next fixed era. If this man from 60 century knew this, either he might sit back and not do anything, thinking the future was fixed anyway, or, which is probably worse, he might get annoyed and do something quite different. And the trouble with unstable eras is that quite small things can change the course of history in them. Is that clear?"
Vivian nodded,
trying to look as clever as the real Cousin Vivian. From the way Mr. Enkian was glowering, she suspected that Sempertan Walker was quite glad she had interrupted.
"And what happens when an unstable era goes critical?"
she asked, before Mr. Enkian could say anything. Sempertan Walker's toothache look subsided to the usual look of mere anguish.
"That," he said, "happens when enough changes happen to the history of that era to change the fixed eras before and after them, as in 20th century at the moment. The change rolls forward first, as you might expect. Now we're having trouble in 23rd century because several inventions which ought to have been made then have been made already in 1940. But the instability is beginning to roll backwards too. Time Patrol are having to work very hard to make sure the Roman Empire..."
Mr. Enkian sprang to his feet, with his pointed yellow face twisted.
"Oh, this is too much!" he shouted.
"Now really, Mr. Enkian,"
Jenny said, sounding crosser than Vivian had ever heard her.
"No,"
said Mr. Enkian.
"I mean that."
He pointed to the rounded end wall of the room.
"Excrescence,"
he said. He was so angry that he was having trouble in speaking. Everyone's head switched that way. The student's time ghost was there. Jonathan swallowed what he was eating and crammed his pigtail into his mouth. Vivian slammed both hands across her face so that no one should see her laughing. It was such cheek of the student's. The tall, crazy-looking man with his high, floppy hat was standing against the half-circle of wall, obviously projected there like a film, leering at them like a slightly anxious court jester. Vivian felt she knew his long, lunatic face quite well by now.
"Go away,"
Mr. Enkian said, still pointing. The court jester's answer was to spread its hands out towards him pleadingly. Its leer became a mad grin. Jonathan's parents exchanged looks. Sempertan Walker cleared his throat and stood up.
"That will do now," he said.
"Turn your apparatus off, please."
The court jester's grin faded. It looked almost as agonized as the Sempertan. Its mouth opened as if it were about to speak.
"I said remove this vision, please, at once,"
said Sempertan Walker,
"or you will find yourself up before Chronologue for contempt."
The ghost's mouth closed. It looked resigned. It bowed its head to the Sempertan and backed away through the wall, leaving everyone with a faint after-image, like sun-dazzle, of its strange, lanky shape.
"Quite a realistic hollow,"
someone said.
"At least this time they left out those awful bagpipes,"
said somebody else. And everyone began talking about the false ghost, or soothing Mr. Enkian, who seemed to think the thing was a personal insult to himself. Vivian said nothing for the rest of the meal. Now she had had a clear and detailed look at the apparition. She knew why she thought she knew its face. It was the same face, and the same floppy hat, that she had seen coming through one of the time locks up the River Tyne, ignoring the panic-stricken rush of the other time-ghosts running the other way. She was trying to think where she had seen it before that.
"I don't think that thing was a holophone,"
she said to Jonathan afterwards.
"Yes, but 56th century holography is wildly realistic," he answered, and went off to write his essay.
"Or a hollow giraffe either,"
Vivian muttered as she crawled back to her own tasks. The translation came out as nonsense twice. At this point, Vivian's brain gave out and began arguing at her. There was no point in flogging it like this, it told her. She was going home to Mum before long, and the best thing she could do was to think of ways of getting there. "Not at the moment," her brain added hastily. One more thought would kill it. But it was her duty to sit there at least feeling restfully homesick, instead of going on to learn that awful chart. She picked up the chart a little guiltily. It was perfectly true, as her brain pointed out, that she had hardly spared a moment being homesick, except just a little at night for the last 2 days. That was because of the two time ghosts in the passage. She knew she could not go home until she had been somewhere else with Jonathan and then come back to Time City again. And as soon as she realized this, she also realized that she was unlikely to get to wherever it was and back, and then home without seeing Dr. Willander again. And Dr. Willander was going to make tears of laughter run down Jonathan's face at her expense, unless she did better than last time. That was enough to set Vivian bending over the history chart in earnest. She fell asleep that night, murmuring, "First unstable era, 300 AD to 2199. Second unstable era, 3800 to 3950. Third unstable era, 5700 to 6580. Fourth unstable era, oh, isn't history long?" And when she awoke in the morning, her head was still swimming with things she almost knew. As she went downstairs that morning, Sempiterne Walker came flying down past her in a rustling plum-coloured cloak.
"Elio!" he shouted. "Elio!"
Vivian hurried down after him, certain there was going to be another ceremony and another fuss. But it did not look like it. Elio was waiting in the hall with Sam's father.
"Oh, you got him. Good,"
said the Sempiterne, swooping down on the pair of them.
"Any news of that holo projector yet?"
"Time Patrol is working on it, sir," said Elio.
"It's among about a million other things. That projector must have its own power pack. It's not drawing any from the city,"
Mr. Donegal said, and he nodded at Vivian.
"Hello there."
To Vivian's surprise, Sempiterne Walker nodded at her too and said,
"Good morning,"
before he swept Mr. Donegal and Elio off to his study, leaving Vivian rather disappointed that there was no more rushing about than that. She was still hoping and listening when she and Jonathan had to set off to duration. Sam was waiting by the fountain in Time Close as usual.
"I'm not speaking to either of you,"
he announced.
"You went off without me."
"Well, we had work to do from Dr. Willander," Jonathan said.
"I don't mean that, stupid," said Sam. "I mean you went without me, wherever your two time ghosts were coming back from. You green, mean obscenes, both of you."
"No, we didn't," said Vivian.
"Stupid yourself,"
Jonathan said, stalking ahead to the archway into Eon Square.
"We haven't been there yet."
"Then you will soon,"
Sam said, pounding after him in a patter of shoelace.
"What's the difference? I know you're going to."
"I'd go without you this moment, if I'd the least idea what we were doing,"
Jonathan said angrily over his shoulder.
"And you've no right to blame us for something we haven't done yet,"
Vivian added, also over her shoulder. The court jester apparition was leaning against the brick wall under the archway. The long, mad-looking face turned towards them as they came through. Jonathan nearly ran into Vivian, because they had both been looking the other way until the last minute. They stumbled to a stop and stared. Somehow, in the dimness under the arch, the false ghost seemed both harder to see and a great deal more solid. He towered over them both, and he seemed to be watching them earnestly.
"Well, I do blame you,"
Sam said, stumping into the archway after them. He stopped when he saw the apparition. His voice went to a heavy whisper.
"It looks awfully real."
Jonathan swallowed.
"But he's not,"
he said.
"If you tried to touch him, your hand would hit the wall."
The court jester's mouth spread into a long, long smile.
"Come, try me," he said.
His voice was distant and indistinct, like a man speaking in another room, and he held out a long, shadowy arm, almost in Jonathan's face. Jonathan ducked away back from it immediately. That left Vivian out in front. She pulled in a deep breath.
"I'll try,"
she said, and went forward towards the outstretched arm, with her own arm and hand held stiffly out like a sleepwalker. And her hand met something. As it did, it gave Vivian a jolt of the sort of fear you feel on finding yourself face to face with a large, fierce dog. Not that the ghost was fierce. She just had the feeling that it hated to be touched. The arm she met was not exactly solid, but it was not nothing either. It was coldish, and the cloth of the sleeve was rough. And though her hand did not sink into that arm, she knew that the flesh and the cloth over it were made of something that was spread thinner than normal.
"I can feel you,"
she said, and found she was whispering.
"You're not a hologramophone, are you?"
"No, I am real,"
the ghost said in its strange, muffled voice.
"You may all touch and believe."
Its smile died away, and it looked sad. But it stood patiently holding its arm out while first Jonathan, then Sam, came and put their fingers on the rough cloth of its sleeve. Sam prodded a bit, and the ghost endured it patiently. Sam backed away, looking awed. Jonathan cleared his throat, but even so his voice came out choky.
"It's sort of solid."
The ghost took its arm away, and for a moment they all stared at one another, as if everyone, including the ghost, needed to recover from the experience.
"What do you want?"
Jonathan said at length.
"To make my trouble known," said the ghost.
The dejected thread of its voice seemed to wind about the archway and come to them from several directions at once. Probably, Vivian thought. Its voice was spread as thin as the rest of it.
"I have tried to make folk in the city hear me," it said. "But I have little substance here without my casket, and they take me for a ghost."
"Well, you can't blame people for thinking that, when you go galloping about playing the bagpipes in the middle of a ceremony,"
Jonathan said. The ghost shook its head with a sad, puzzled smile.
"Did I do that? My memory is not good. I did not remember until last night that it was you I should be speaking to. Then I came and tried, but a powerful man dismissed me in the name of Chronologue, and I had no choice but to depart."
"You mean you wanted us?"
Jonathan said incredulously.
"What are you?" said Sam. "If you're not a ghost, really."
"Myself," said the ghost. "I am the one who was set to guard the iron casket, and I failed. You saw how I failed. You saw the casket dug up and stolen from its place."
"Oh," they all said. And Vivian thought, of course. This was the man with long legs, who had run past them so easily up the tor, shouting at them to hurry. He had looked a lot more solid then. She looked down at his almost solid foot, standing on the cobblestones. She recognized those pointed shoes now. From the look of Sam and Jonathan, they knew him too.
"But why did you go and vanish?" Sam said. "You just let the boy get on and steal it."
The guardian of the iron casket spread his big, pale hands helplessly.